Welcome to a special encore hour of the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and all this week, we are focusing on some of our favorite arts and entertainment conversations we have had on the 21st. Coming up today, the Cran Arts Center for the Performing Arts in Urbana celebrated its 50th anniversary this year, and we thought that would be a good time to look at how performing arts thrives outside of big cities. But first, on June 23rd, in 2014, a Methodist minister named Charles Moore set himself on fire in a Dollar General parking lot of his hometown, Grand Saline, Texas. Why he did that remains a mystery, one that filmmakers Joel Fendelman and James Chase Sanchez try to answer in their documentary, Man on Fire.
What's that? 911.
This is Angie at the Dollar General.
In what city?
At Grant Saline, and the man's on fire out in the parking lot.
The man is on fire?
Yes, a man just set himself on fire.
I spoke with Joel and James back in March when they were in Central Illinois for a screening of that documentary, which has also appeared on PBS's Frontline. They stopped by our Urbana studios before their event. Gentlemen, welcome to the 21st.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Glad to be here.
So first, I just wanted to ask you, I didn't know that much about this story, that he was a minister and this was an attempt to have a public call to repent for the racism that he saw, particularly treatment of African-Americans in his town. James, this is your hometown, so I imagine you knew about this when this happened.
Yeah, I lived in Fort Worth, which is about 2 hours from Grand Saline, and I immediately heard about it on social media. But the conversation wasn't so much about why he did it. It was just that someone was quote unquote crazy and had lit themselves on fire. And then about 2 days later, I contacted the editor at the Grand Saline Sun newspaper and was trying to find out more information. And I got the letter that Charles Moore left on his car windshield titled, "Oh, Grand Saline, Repent of Your Racism." And immediately I read the letter and it reminded me so much of my upbringing in Grand Saline as a person of color. And I kind of got chills because Charles Moore was talking about these experiences that he had with the KKK and lynchings in the 1940s and 50s. And these were stories that I remember hearing quite vividly in the early 2000s growing up there. And so I immediately felt this instant connection with Charles Moore and knew I needed to do a project on him.
Joel, how did you hear about this?
Well, I heard about it through a mutual friend that Chase and I had who connected me with James. And then I read this article by Michael Hall in the Texas Monthly, who did a very long feature about it. But I was living in Austin, Texas at the time, and just moved there actually a few months after this happened, but had not heard about it until a year later when I was turned on to Chase and this article. And it was really kind of punched in the gut hearing about what Charles Moore did and the reasons for why he did this and these questions of, well, what am I doing in this world to make this place a better place? And here's this man who set himself on fire to bring social justice. And that really got me hooked. And so,
James, you mentioned your upbringing, and I wanted to just ask you if you could first tell us a little bit about Grand Saline. We learn a lot about Grand Saline if you watch the documentary about the town, about how big it is, but also not just about its present, but its past. What was it like to grow up there? So you're Latino?
Yeah.
What's the demographic makeup of
sure.
the town? Because it sounds like there's really no black people
yeah,
in the town.
Zero black people live in town. I think when I grew up there, there was no black people lived in town. I think the 2010 census says that there are 10 black people. I think a few of them are children who are mixed race, but there are no black families that I know of who live in town. And it's just interesting, when you grow up in East Texas, in this town in particular, these racism was so common in everyday life that you just think that's how the world exists. And so the town was very racist against black people. The N-word was used all the time. I remember, like, when we would play black people in sports, there'd be people saying, like, look at these monkeys walking around on their hind legs. It was so common. But
people would say that, like, just for a high school game?
Yeah, just it was very common for high schoolers to have these conversations. But it wasn't just high schoolers. There were elders in the community who perpetuated this racism.
And just to be
well.
Clear, this was when you were growing up. So this was like 15 years, like 10, 15
yeah,
years
I
ago?
Yeah, I graduated in 2006.
Okay,
so,
10 years ago.
Yeah, and there's so many stories about that. Like, my nickname in high school was Wetback and Beaner. And there's nothing I can do about it. I mean, there's a small Latino population, but, you know, we didn't have any authority in this space. But there are also things that, as a community, was okay. And I think one of them that really stands out to me is at the end of pep rallies for the football game, for the football team before our games, we'd come together in a high school gym, and our slogan was, "We're all right because we're all white." I'm not white. I didn't fit that bill. And that always stuck out to me, not because kids were saying this, but because it was said in front of coaches and elders in the community who could clearly hear this but would never say anything about it. And once I moved away from Grant Saline, I realized, look how racist this environment is. And that has always stuck with me since I moved away. And I think when Charles Moore set himself on fire, I knew this would be a perfect vehicle to further explore the racism in my hometown.
Mm. And so I wanted to play some clips. You guys talked to a lot of different people for this. And this is actually the city administrator, Rex White. And this is his response when you asked him about racism in Grand Saline.
Grand Saline holding some kind of racism or racist idea as a community, that doesn't exist. And I don't think we have to continue to talk about that. If you're not careful, it'll stir all that up again and it'll be perpetuated again. And that's not something we want to happen because it needs to go away. And it goes away because the good people of Grand Saline do not perpetuate it. It's talked about far less here than it might be in other places.
That's Rex White, the city administrator for Grand Saline, and that's a clip from Man on Fire. We're talking about this documentary with producer James Chase Sanchez and director Joel Fendelman, who are in studio with me here in Urbana. So, guys, there's a lot in there, right? And I wanted to wonder if we can just kind of talk a little bit about, first of all, not just his reaction, but I think also, and I think this is particularly relevant in today's America, using the word racism, it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. So first, I just wonder, when Rex White said that to him, James, were you surprised after you? Or, so you're sort of, you're contrasting what you've just shared of your personal experience, yeah, and then hearing him say, no, people are good. And I've heard people say this. I've heard people say this everywhere. I've heard people say this in Illinois. Like, we're good people, so we can't be racist.
Yeah. I think before even answering that, a little context is needed in that. It took Rex, this was probably the third try to get Rex on film, and he didn't come on film until he talked to the city council and the lawyer in the town, and they decided they should have someone come on film because it would be best for them as the city. And so I just took my personal experiences are totally different from Rex's. The people in the town absolutely talk about this all the time. And it just shows me this idea again about how white people try to deflect from any real conversation. There are major racial problems in Grant Saline, but the easier thing to do is to not talk about it and just say, like, this is old, this is history, we don't have to talk about these issues anymore. When in reality, there are still many people in the town who hold very racist sentiments and very explicit and implicit forms.
And Joel, so I wanted to ask you about that as well. One thing we've talked about occasionally here on the 21st is Illinois' history of having sundown towns. And we've talked about how many sundown towns there were across Illinois. And for people who aren't familiar, it's basically a town where it was either illegal or unsafe for Black people to be there after dark. And this was, Grand Saline was a sundown town.
Well, we weren't able to actually confirm.
Because that's another part. There was actually a sign, though.
Well, that's one of the things. I mean, there were stories of a sign, and I think lots of evidence that shows there probably was a sign, but we never were actually able to find an actual sign. So it becomes this hearsay. Like, everyone says, well, I knew someone who saw a sign. Or we have the one person, Chet, on camera who says, oh, someone I worked with had a sign. It's probably in his game room
somewhere.
And
what did the sign say?
Well, it'd say something like,
don't let the sun set on your black ass.
Yeah, something like that. Or something worse. On the entrance and exit to the...
To the town. Okay.
But like you're saying, like something... I mean, I'd never heard of this. I grew up in Miami in a city. I'm a city boy. So coming out to Texas and to East Texas was a whole nother world. So then learning about this idea of sundown towns, like, oh, yeah, that's a southern thing, right? But no, it's not. You come out to Illinois in the north, sundown towns were everywhere. And there's a great book, James Loewen, called Sundown
Towns. Yeah, he's actually been on, James has been on the 21st talking about his research on sundown towns. So let me ask you, when you guys were working on this, did you worry at all about reinforcing stereotypes of the South or having viewers think like this is what all of Texas is like if you are taking a snapshot of this one town and their history?
It's a really good question. I don't think we've been asked that before. I would say there's always a fear of essentializing this town as far as we're showing some people. And to be honest, we didn't put in like all the worst things that we heard. There were definitely worse things that didn't make it into the film that we actively chose not to put in because we thought it sensationalized it too much. And a lot of the racism in the community is a lot more on this covert level. So I don't know if I feared essentialization of them, of being pegged as, look at Grant Saline, the most racist town, or this is indicative of the South or Texas in general. And I think how I know that's true is that we've done a fair amount of screenings, and every time after a screening, especially in different places from the South, someone comes up to me and will say, have you ever heard of Blink and Blake, Ohio, or so-and-so, Indiana, or so-and-so, Illinois? And everyone knows a community that fulfills the same role as Grant Saline. And so while I think there are concerns as far as are we sort of pegging Grant Saline as this racist town, I think for the most part, viewers walk away knowing this isn't just Grant Saline. This is a problem in all of America. And there's a lot of small towns like this throughout America.
We haven't talked about Charles Moore, who is the guy who inspired this film. And we actually have a clip of something his high school friend, Don Vickery, said about him. Let's take a listen to that.
Charles could have been anything he wanted to be. He was a bright, bright guy. And yet he saw fit to take up the cause of the minorities and to do good, do some good by sacrificing himself, so he thought.
That's Don Vickery talking about his friend, Minister Charles Moore, who is the subject of this documentary, Man on Fire. James Chase Sanchez and Joel Fendelman are in studio with me. They're the two guys behind this. What else did you learn about Charles Moore in doing this? I mean, obviously someone who is going to set himself on fire, writes this long letter that he leaves saying this is why he's doing this. This is something he thought about very carefully to contrast what you were thinking, James, and what people talked about immediately, like this is a crazy person.
And I get that when someone first hears about this incident, a man sets himself on fire, oh, he must have been crazy. And I mean, that's my first reaction when I hear about someone self-immolating in the States. But once you dive in a little bit deeper and you start to explore, it's like you said, this was a very deliberate act. He spent years thinking about this. He had a lifelong history of civil rights activism.
Including in Chicago.
Including in Chicago.
Moving his family to the west side of Chicago in the 60s. Mm-hmm.
And so when you put that all into context, James and I both walk away from this thinking this was a very thought out act. And to call him crazy, I mean, I think we both see as a way of not dealing with why he did this.
When you study his life, you see that he was so dedicated to civil rights, to the detriment of his family. I think one of the things that really stood out that didn't make it into the film is that Charles Moore did about a 15-day hunger strike in the mid-90s to protest the Methodist Church's stance on LGBTQ people in the community.
Something that's been in the news lately as well.
And he got them to change their policy from actively taking a negative stance to just having really no stance, saying that everyone it's accepted under the grace of God. And I think that's something that to me is this microcosm of this one thing he did that really shows everything that Charles Moore stood for his entire life. So when you study his life, I think you see what he chose to do to end his life, and you're not really surprised anymore.
There's so many questions that this film leaves you with afterwards. And I wonder, after the experience of doing this, what questions what did this leave you guys thinking about?
We look at Grant Saline, we look at East Texas, and it's so easy to point the finger at the people in East Texas and say, well, those people, they're in the past. They haven't modernized their way of thinking. They're not enlightened in any way. And those people over there. But how can we ask the question of, well, what part of Grand Saline is in my community, in my town, in my family, in me? And that's the deep question I always want people to walk away with.
I mean, there's a question that one woman says, or an opinion she voices. She's like, how can I repent for what white people did years ago? And I think that's a question a lot of people ask.
Yeah, and I think that the problem is that if you just view this as a historical racist history and it's something that doesn't exist in the present, that's the way that you would walk away from this subject. But I think all research shows that, you know, racism post-civil rights is very institutionalized in so many communities. And it's easier for us to take defensive stances and say, this is something that passed. I don't have to repent for it. While not showing that we still have these same biases. We still uphold these systems of racism that are very present in most communities around America.
That's James Chase Sanchez. You also heard from Joel Fendelman. They're the men behind the documentary Man on Fire. We spoke with them back in March when they were on campus here in Central Illinois. We have to take a quick break. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. For 50 years, people in Central Illinois have been coming to the Krannert Center to see performers like Yo-Yo Ma and Joshua Bell, as well as ballet companies, acrobats, and musicians from all over the world. This year, they celebrated those five decades with a Come Home to Krannert Center weekend. It's an achievement not just for the University of Illinois, but for art in Illinois. And it got us here at The 21st thinking about other great arts organizations and institutions in the state that exist outside of Chicago. This April, as Krannert celebrated, we gathered a few folks to join us for a conversation. Here in studio with me in Urbana is Mike Ross, the director of the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. In Springfield, at our partner station WUIS, Betsy Dollar is the executive director of the Springfield Arts Association. And from the town of Normal, Adam Fox is a civic arts manager who oversees programming at the Normal Theater. Mike, Betsy, Adam, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for joining me.
Good morning to you.
Mike, I wanted to start with Krannert, thinking about 50 years. We've got people who are listening throughout the state of Illinois who maybe aren't as familiar with Krannert's mission. What's the easiest way to understand what you all are trying to do at the Krannert Center?
Be glad to respond to that. And I'd also like to start by saying there are two Krannerts at the University of Illinois, the Krannert Art Museum and Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, both made possible through the generosity of Herman and Elnora Krannert. Herman was an alum of the College of Engineering here at Illinois. In reflection of the land-grant public university mission of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, we think of Krannert Center as a potent blending of classroom, laboratory, and public square. And as such, Krannert Center has a deep commitment and responsibility to support the academic performing arts programs, that is to say, the School of Music and the departments of dance and theater. And it also has a deep responsibility and commitment to, as a public square, to present a very diverse and robust spectrum of performances across those art forms.
And when we think about how far do people travel to come to the Krannert Center here to attend your performances?
We've had people travel literally from all over the world, actually, to
in the audience, yes. To attend performances as well.
Yes, I was talking about, I meant to say audience members. For example, when we have our biennial Elnora Guitar Festival, we have guitar enthusiasts that literally come from all over the country. But on an ongoing basis for our programming, people will come from Chicago, St. Louis, Indianapolis, but the vast majority of our audiences on an ongoing basis are from within a 75-mile radius or so in central Illinois.
Yeah, that's still a pretty big radius. And I wonder, Betsy Dollar is also with us with the Springfield Arts Association. So, Betsy, we've been talking about Krannert celebrating 50 years. The Springfield Arts Association is actually twice as old. How did this get started?
Well, the primary difference here is that we are a visual arts organization primarily and not performing arts. But it was actually started by three women who believed that all of society could be improved through beauty and the education of the arts, so that the more people understood the visual arts and beauty, the better overall society would be. So they created the Springfield Art Association to basically educate the people of the Springfield area in the visual arts, anywhere from teaching classes, bringing in lots of visiting artists and lectures and opportunities to experience the arts for everyone.
And that's still true today, Betsy?
Yes, yes.
And Adam, when we're thinking, we've got three very different arts organizations, when we're talking about the Normal Theater, also quite a historic institution opening in 1936. I wonder, can you tell us a little bit about the theater and if what you all know has changed since then?
Well, sure. Back in 1937, when the theater opened, it was independently operated, single screen cinema in the heart of Normal to bring film to the community. And it went through a lot of different iterations over the years, eventually falling into relative disrepair until the town of Normal said, we've got this real gem here and we're watching it sort of wither away. And in 1994, the town reopened the theater under its ownership and operation. So we are a unique entity. There's very, very few art house cinemas that are part of a municipality and are considered in much the same way as programming like the pools and things like that about quality of life and something that really matters. So we're in our 25th anniversary now under town leadership, and it's a really remarkable organization to be able to look at community from within the community. It's a wonderful relationship.
So it's nice to have the three of you here and think about the more than a century of work doing arts across Illinois. And I don't know if you can have that conversation without talking about funding. And Adam, I just wanted to ask you, when we think about the Normal Theater being part of a municipal city budget, I wonder how that changes what you want to do and what you're able to do?
Well, we're certainly aware of it. I guess I'll say that. The wonderful thing that happened when the theater first opened is that the commitment was made by the town to not try to directly influence the programming of the theater. The realization that the stories being told on screen had value, and the hope, of course, is that people would come out, that financially it would be well supported by that, but that there was a value in those stories being told irrespective of that. It was never meant to be a profit generator. It was meant to try and share those stories that would resonate with all members of the community. So likewise, and this is perhaps tangential, but there's no real censorship considerations as far as, well, is this the right film to show at a community venue? The town has been very supportive always of saying there is a value in all art as long as it's framed and contextualized correctly. So we certainly consider it, and of course we're hoping that every seat is full in the theater every single night, but we also know that there's some programming that's a little bit more niche or specific, and that there's a real value in that too. So it's a balancing act, to be sure.
Right. That's Adam Fox, the Civic Arts Manager for the Town of Normal, talking to us about the Normal Theater. Mike Ross is also in studio with me here in Urbana, where he's director for the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. And Mike, when we think about the funding model for Krannert, obviously, I imagine being attached to the University of Illinois, I wonder if that's given you maybe more stability than if we're thinking about other standalone arts organizations. How the funding structure has changed of Krannert over the years, though, correct?
Yes, it has. In sync with the funding that has changed, the state funding that has changed for the university at large. I am very fond of stating that, in my view, the business model, the financial model of Krannert Center is utterly dependent upon the unflinching commitment of university leadership and the passionate generosity of our donors. Every year, roughly a third of our budget is provided by the University of Illinois, and that's primarily to cover the bulk of our staff salaries. But we rely very heavily on contributed support and also our earned revenues, which are a mix of ticket sales. We have some rental income, and then there's income that comes in from our food services and our Promenade gift shop and showcase.
When we're thinking about arts organizations and funding, for you, how much of the continuing funding is one of your biggest challenges or something you spend a lot of time thinking about?
We spend an enormous amount of time thinking about this. And Krannert Center has been fortunate for a long time to have a very talented and dedicated staff, part of whom are dedicated to the development and fundraising efforts. As part of our 50th anniversary celebration, in fact, we are in the midst of a very ambitious $30 million Endow the Dream campaign to enhance our existing endowment and to ensure that we are able to pursue our mission vigorously and have the kind of impact on this region that we want to have. And so, yes, it's very much on our minds all the time.
Betsy, what about for you? I mean, when we're thinking about you being in our state capital and thinking about all of the conversations for state funding and for thinking about people arguing for funding for things like housing or food, how is it ever hard to convince people of the necessity for arts and arts education in a community like Springfield?
Oh, absolutely. I would say that a huge chunk of the population perceives the arts in general and, the visual arts perhaps in particular, as a luxury and something for the wealthy or the higher end. And so it's an ongoing challenge to convince everyone that art has value for everyone at every age and every income level, and that the world is a much better place when your creativity and imagination are utilized. And I am constantly making the case for really improved education around the arts and far more integration of the arts into every learning situation, so that there isn't this huge chasm between, oh, the arts are for the people over there, and everybody else who's trying to survive is over here. I firmly believe that the arts enhance daily survival, and it really helps to have a good imagination and some creative approach, and that whether it's film or music or painting or whatever, that we really serve people to, unleash that inner creativity. We all have it, but so much of our daily environment is very busy beating that out of us. And I think that we need to turn back to that as a resource for, everyone, and to enhance our communities through the arts. Mm. But it is always an uphill battle. And I totally agree that we all rely very heavily on the passionate generosity of the few.
Mm-hmm. We'd love to hear from our listeners, by the way. If you want to share your favorite or most memorable performance you've ever attended at Krannert, you can text us at 217-394-5765. That's 217-394-5765. I will share. I really enjoyed seeing the UI Black Chorus. This was actually just a very recent performance. This was 2 months ago. I've been to many performances at Krannert, but just listening to the acoustics and listening to that music and that sound of that chorus. Mike, I wonder if we could, just to Betsy's point about the arts, just ask a little bit about the building and the acoustics itself and when this was constructed, when we're thinking about Krannert Center. I understand even the Chicago Symphony Orchestra comes to record here in Urbana because of the acoustics of the Great Hall, correct?
The orchestra has recorded some of its most significant and landmark recordings at Krannert Center in the Follinger Great Hall because of those acoustics. The Great Hall is a great place to start when you think about Krannert Center. And for those folks out in your listenership who are not familiar with Krannert Center, in addition to the Great Hall, which is a beautifully designed concert hall, we have two proscenium theaters, the Tryon Festival Theater and the Caldwell Playhouse Theater. And we also have a black box theater, which we call the Studio Theater. In addition to all those performance spaces, we have a full array of production shops, as in scene shop, costumes, props, audio and lighting, and we have a full array of rehearsal spaces, the footprints of which mimic the stage dimensions of each of the theaters, so that when students and faculty are rehearsing in those spaces, they can easily move from those spaces right onto the stage of the theater in which they are doing their public performing without having to adjust their spacing, et cetera. And there are the lobby itself is an important element of the design of Krannert Center. Herman and Elnora Krannert wanted for there to be a vast lobby space where before and after performances in the theaters, people could come together in spite of their preference for that moment for seeing either dance or theater or music. In
they're
the
all
spaces.
Together they're, in the lobby, no matter what arts they've, whatever performance they've seen earlier.
Yes, and if I could just add one more comment, one of the things that we've done over the years is add to our lobby a stage, we call it Stage 5, and a bar, and we create an ongoing club-style setting. We feature local artists all the time, as well as faculty and students, and it's a joyous enterprise. And when Krannert Center was built and opened in 1969, it captured the attention of all of the cultural elites in the performing arts on the East Coast and the West Coast, because nobody imagined ever that a facility of this complexity and comprehensiveness, vastness and beauty would appear in the Heartland the way Krannert Center did.
And so I wonder if we can end just by asking, and Adam, let me start with you. I wonder if you could just think, if you can just answer the question about why it's so important to have things like the Normal Theater or Krannert, or as we've been talking to the Springfield Arts Association, and have this exist outside of the coasts or even outside of Chicago.
I think what Betsy said was really fantastic, the notion that the arts is for everybody, and that's from both performance but also participation. We have this assumption that the arts are for something, you know, are something that people over there can do, right? They're up on stage, they can do it, and maybe that's not for me because I haven't made it. I haven't achieved that as my profession. That's not my vocation, but the arts are for every day, for every person, for their entire life. And participation in the arts is a really critical element of having a thriving community, having a better perspective and growing as a person. And I think when you have these vibrant art centers and these commitments within communities to say the arts matter, you just see that have an impact on everybody on every level.
That's Adam Fox, Civil Arts Manager for the Town of Normal. You also heard from Mike Ross, Director of the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, and Betsy Dollar, Executive Director of the Springfield Arts Association. Coming up after the break, we're revisiting a conversation about Chicago's very own Hamilton exhibition. Stay close, you're listening to The 21st. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Just you wait. Alexander Hamilton. Alexander Hamilton. You're waiting in the wings for you. Waiting in the wings for you. You never back down. You never learn to take your time. Sound familiar? It's been more than 3 years since Hamilton first opened on Broadway. And since then, it's spread to dozens of major cities across the country, even to the UK. And we've seen Hamilton grow beyond the musical itself in the form of additional music, even a new book. This past fall, Chicago got its own exclusive exhibition on Northerly Isle, Hamilton, the Exhibition. It's billed as a one-of-a-kind interactive look at the story of America's founding, all told from the perspective of Alexander Hamilton. Chris Jones is the Chicago Tribune's theater critic, and he reported on this for the newspaper. We spoke with him last year before the exhibition opened. Hi, Chris. Welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Nice to talk to you.
Yes. Yeah, so, Hamilton, the exhibition, because who could have predicted that Hamilton is still maybe not as incredibly popular as it was, but certainly it hasn't really waned that much interest in the musical or even now Alexander Hamilton.
Well, one of the reasons it's not weighing that much is that they're very, very good at keeping it in everybody's, keeping attention on the show, whether it's sort of dropping new recordings or, you know, mixtapes, or in this case, an exhibition. So, I mean, Lin-Manuel Miranda has just been incredibly adept at, you know, rather than writing a new show, he's just continued to sort of, I guess you'd say promote, but also to just kind of extend the brand of Hamilton itself.
And there has really been, and you talked to him about this, I think even he's surprised at the level of interest that people have in the actual historical person of Alexander Hamilton.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, whenever people ask me, why is this show the way it is? You know, why is there this level of demand? What the heck, you know? And it is an enormous level of demand, as you say. And I think in part it's because it's a substantial piece of art. And what I mean by that is it's not even Harry Potter or Frozen. It's about America. It's about the founding of the nation. It has a historical importance, and people see it as crucial, particularly for young people, for education. So he's been able to get people all the way up to President Obama, of course, and the First Lady, effectively promoting the show for him. And so I think this is in some ways an acknowledgement of that and an attempt to kind of create, you know, a new experience for Hamilton fans. And essentially, from what I can understand, and I've seen renderings of pretty much of everything that they're going to do. So the deal is there's a tent-like structure, whether it's a tent might not be quite the right word, a temporary structure anyway, that's going to be on Northerly Island in Chicago, which is right out in the lake. Now, it doesn't open till November, so it's going to be really cold if you go out there in the first several weeks. So that's interesting, but that's a whole other issue. And then you're going to go there, you're going to pay your $35 or thereabouts, and you're going to walk through a kind of interactive exhibit, really all about Hamilton, the man, Alexander, that is, and all about the founding of this nation. And the thing that will make it different, of course, and the reason everybody will go, is that Lin-Manuel Miranda, maybe in hologram form or verbal form, will be your guide. And the exhibit obviously has access to the show. So, for example, the songs will be playing as part of your tour. The lyrics will be on the walls of the exhibit. So what they're going to be able to do that no other museum has really been able to do is integrate, you know, sort of an exhibition on American history with the biggest hit show of the, you know, last 100 years. So that's basically what's going on.
And Chris, to your point, Hamilton the Musical is a work of art. How much of this exhibition is about then the actual history, the actual facts of Alexander Hamilton's life?
Well, I think the exhibition is entirely about the facts of Alexander Hamilton's life. However, it is presented through a theatrical lens. So when they explained it all to me, there's a lot of very interesting kind of theatrical things you're going to be able to do. There's going to be a recreation of the room where it happened. There's going to be they're going to give people a sense of what happened when Hamilton moved uptown. You know, after the death of his kid, there's a famous song in the musical where he goes uptown. It's quiet uptown, if you remember that song. And that, of course, back in the day, that was a trek into the, even though they were moving to essentially Upper Manhattan, it was a trek to into the rural world, if you like. So they're going to recreate that. There's going to be an ability to talk about what kind of presidency America should have now as it did then. So it's very much about the guy. I don't think that there's nothing in the exhibit on like how they made the show, or it's not like that. It's not a backstory to Hamilton the show. But it's all done by theater people, so it's going to be very immersive. And it's also very expensive. Like, I think they're spending, they wouldn't say exactly, but I think probably $10-15 million on this exhibit. So, I mean, it's not going to be, you know, knocking around in a tent with a few display cases, if you know what I mean. It's going to be a lot more than that.
And I'm just thinking about the young people, and I'm thinking in particular of my nieces and nephews. My 6-year-old niece can do the entire Skylar Sisters rap. So I think that they're for children, and I'm thinking about children who love Hamilton, the musical. It sounds like a really interesting opportunity to present history in a way that hasn't been done before. And I suppose if someone could do that here, it would be Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I don't think anything like this has ever quite been done in the same way, because most artworks or most shows, for example, are not, you know, you can't really have frozen the exhibition, right? You could have an exhibition on how they made it, but they're not, there's not anything there at the end of the day. Whereas with Hamilton, you actually have, it's a bio musical, so you actually have this very important guy who was there really at the founding of American democracy. And the show has been highly successful in part because, you know, it's emphasized the fact that he was an immigrant. And of course, it uses a very diverse cast. So you have the sense that this history is for everybody and that the founding of America is an issue that everybody, you know, should be involved in. And so I think it really will, you know, have an enormous impact educationally. I mean, there is this question about how many people will go. Now, it's $35, which is more than it costs you to get in the Field Museum here, more than it costs you to get in the Met, I think. But it's still a lot less than going to the show, obviously.
And I did want to ask you about that cost. And I think particularly we know that musicals like Hamilton aren't affordable for a lot of people, although Lin-Manuel Miranda has really tried to get especially kids and public school students in front of this show. Yes. Do you think that that's also going to be a part of a component of this exhibition, is having school children there? Have you? I don't know if you've talked to him about that.
Yeah, I mean, they said essentially their aim is to have school groups come in for free. So I think, you know, if you're, I think almost all the Chicago public schools will go. I'm sure a lot of the suburban schools will go. I suspect some of the downstate schools will go too. So I think a lot of people will get to see it for free as part of a school group. Now, if you go with your kids, then you probably are going to pay, I'm guessing, about $20 or $25 for the kids, you know, alongside your $35. So, I, you know, they have had a very, they've had a kind of Robin Hood policy at Hamilton where they've charged as much as they possibly can for the really good seats, and then they've given away some seats. But, you know, let's not fool ourselves. For most people, it's a major investment. Now, I do think, you know, if we've been having this conversation a year ago, it was very expensive in Chicago. And I think now you can actually, particularly on a weeknight, particularly when the kids are not out of school, you actually can see Hamilton now for a lot less than you could a year ago, a lot less. And, you know, and I think, you know, particularly if you buy fairly late in the game, there's often a few seats available if you're go on a Tuesday night or Wednesday night where you're not paying an enormous amount of money. So it's not as insane as it was in Chicago because, of course, it's been here for a while now. And the show is every bit as good. It's the same guy playing Hamilton as when it opened. But it's still, I sometimes feel now that people think it's a bit worse than it is, if you know what I'm saying. And you can actually get to see it. It's cheaper here, in fact, way cheaper than it is in Washington, where it's just now landing and the prices there are insane.
Or London. London's. Yeah. I mean, the prices in London are insane, too.
Insane, that's right.
Why Chicago for this exhibition? I mean, Hamilton is in many ways, it's a New York story. It's a Washington story. Why is he opening this exhibition here?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. I think number one is that the show has, other than New York, the show has been here the longest. So that gives you, I think I calculated 1.5 to 1.7 million people have seen Hamilton in Chicago as we have this conversation right now. So that immediately is people who know the show. I would imagine a good percentage of those people would like to have another experience. So that gives them, you know, an audience that they can count on that they wouldn't have in a city that's not been exposed to the show. So that's number one reason. Number two is that you can't do this in New York because there's no space. So you can't, there's nowhere in Manhattan, to be honest, that you could do this because they want to stay. I think their hope in Chicago is they'd be here for 9 months, maybe a year. And they want to stay, and you can't, you know, you can't do this in Central Park. So the only place you can really do it in New York is New Jersey, and they didn't want to go to New Jersey. So I think Chicago has the benefit of the space that allows them to do it, because even the Cirque du Soleil really struggle to find a spot to put their tent in Manhattan. The land is just so expensive there. So Chicago, I think, made sense for that reason.
And I imagine, like the musical itself in Chicago, he's expecting a lot of visitors from outside Chicago to attend this exhibition.
Yeah, I mean, the show has been a major tourist draw, major. I mean, people come from all over the place. Now, that will dissipate a little bit because there's more road tours going out of Hamilton, particularly beginning in the fall. So at that point, there's going to be, you're going to be able to see it in Wisconsin, for example, which you haven't been able to up till now. And the more productions there are, I think that does reduce demand in Chicago if people can see it, you know, in St. Louis, say, or around, you know, the people will have other choices. But, you know, it still remains the majority of people there are from out of town. And I think the exhibition will be a huge draw. I mean, it's starting right before Thanksgiving. So I would imagine it will be really crammed all the way through the end of the holidays. And then, you know, all the businesses in Chicago are pleased because tourism is really light in those cold months, you know, January, February, March. So to have a big new attraction like that is really good news for everybody. So there's a lot of people are like, great, we're going to have more people staying in the hotels and all of that. Now, whether this will really work out, you know, are people going to drive 5 and 6 hours to see what's basically a historical exhibit? And there's no actual artifacts either. You know, that's worth thinking about. You don't get to see any of his actual stuff. It's all just clever, you know,
holograms of Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Exactly. But, you know, in my experience, I got to say, anyone who's bet against Hamilton so far has been wrong. It just has an enormous level of pre-awareness. And it's just, someone said to me a week ago or so, if anyone else was trying to do this on Northerly Island in the winter, they would fail because it's cold out there. It's icy. You know, I'm not quite clear where people are going to park. There's a lot of, you look at it, you go, really? That's not going to be easy. But it's Hamilton. People are just willing to do anything for Hamilton, it seems.
Chris Jones is the Chicago Tribune's theater critic. Chris, thanks for being with me. I appreciate
it. My pleasure.
Does it for us today. You can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. We're also on Facebook if you want to search there for the 21st. You can like us, and it's another way to comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, if you want to leave us a voicemail as well, send us an email, or remember our social media handles, all you have to remember is our website. That's 21stshow.org. We've also got all of our past shows archived there. You can find us also most places you get your podcasts. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, NPR One. Search for The 21ST. We're produced by Libby Foster, Anna Casey, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.